I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Hi, this is Dennis O'Hare. A quick note before we start this edition of The Political Breakfast. Right at the end of our taping, the technical pandemic pixies jumped in again, so my audio quality will change a little bit right before the end here. We ask your indulgence, we thank you for your patience, and we hope you enjoy this edition of The Political Breakfast. While some Georgians rushed to the gas pumps, folks in Atlanta politics were scrambling to figure out what happens now that Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms has decided not to run again this fall. Meanwhile, Governor Kemp signs a bunch of bills that'll probably be part of next year's elections. And one candidate's decision about next year could affect a lot of others. It's a full buffet again on The Political Breakfast, and we've got a place for you. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Republican strategist Brian Robinson is here. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson returns. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Dennis.
Good to be back.
All right, let's start with the biggest political surprise of the last week, the announcement from Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms that she would not seek re-election. Theron, of course, you have worked with the mayor. She said her decision was driven by her faith and by a feeling that it was time to pass the baton. So, Theron, can you tell us perhaps some more of what fed into that?
Yeah, this was a shocking announcement to a lot of us who support Mayor Bottoms. She made it very clear in her announcement that this was something that she was going back and forth for a while, thinking about talking to close family and friends about
and
this.
And real quickly, just to clarify, were you in on her deliberations or were you as surprised as everybody else when she announced?
I was in on it at the very end. Once she was getting ready to make the decision public. And so I told her, you know, look, while I'm saddened that you've made this decision, I think you are a great mayor. You will continue to be a great mayor. I do understand that you have to make the best decision for yourself and your family. And I think the other thing that she really echoed, Dennis, that gave me a great sense of calm and optimism about the next, 6 or 7 months while she's in office, she's deciding not to run from a position of strength. She heard some people shared a poll that was done in Georgia and Atlanta that showed that the mayor still has a high favorability, almost at 70%. And if the election were on that day when the poll was conducted, she would beat all of the announced candidates and some other people who were mentioned. And so I definitely think that it was not because she felt like she was going to not be reelected and that she had received polling numbers and information that encouraged her not to run. This was simply a personal decision that she wanted to also get out of the race in quick enough time to allow someone or he or she to decide to run so they'll have an opportunity to run the campaign. And so, again, it was definitely a shocker to all of us that she decided to not run for reelection. And I would just say this to our listeners, let's not talk about it as if she's resigned or she's dead. I think you're going to see some very bold ideas, some very energetic, innovative initiatives that she's going to put forth in her last few months in office.
Was it as simple, though, as a quote from one source in the AJC, I think it was, who said, her heart's just not in it anymore? Was it that?
I think that is not correct. I mean, the mayor's heart is in it and will always be in it. When she talked about it publicly and privately to me and others who are very close to her, she started by saying that she loves the city. She loves Atlanta. I mean, nobody is more Atlanta than Keisha Lance Bottoms. I mean, if you look at our former mayors, she, I think, is one of the few that have actually been born and raised in Atlanta. And so this notion that her heart wasn't in it, that she doesn't love the city, it's just blatantly false. I think what it really came down to, Dennis, is that not only in Atlanta, but you're seeing it across the country. Incumbent elected officials, particularly elected mayors, are making some very tough decisions about their personal and professional future. And so, again, I think you're going to see her come out with some very, very bold ideas, particularly public safety, something that she's going to now be able to come out and tell the public about what she's going to do to reduce crime in a city. I mean, she made Rodney Bryan a permanent chief. She's not indicted. She's not sick. She's not going to work for Walgreens. I thought that was extremely laughable.
Yeah, Theron knows a lot more about what's going on internally at Atlanta City Hall than I do or probably ever will. All I have is an outsider's perspective and somebody who has, you know, watched politics and been inside of politics for a long time now. But there have been warning signs for some time. You know, she went into her election year with less than $100,000 in the bank. 4 years before, Kasim Reed had $1.1 million at that juncture. I trust what Theron's saying about her going back and forth. Otherwise, why would she then turn around and hold a $500,000 fundraiser using the time of the President of the United States, which is precious time? You got to think that there are some irritated feelings at the White House after last week's announcement, given that, you know, Biden did that favor for her. But again, I'm not an insider. And so Theron's word means more than mine on whether her heart just wasn't in it. But as an outsider watching, it's never seemed like her heart was in it. And she said in our news conference, I thought this was striking, that she knew her first year in office, she wasn't sure that she liked this job or wasn't sure she would want to stay in this job. So that just shows somebody who from day one was like, yeah, this isn't quite what I hoped it would be. And look, it is a hard job. It's a lot of attention. It's tough decisions on the executive level in a large municipality. And she has had, just like Brian Kemp has had, a bunch of weird stuff pop up on her from, you know, the riots last year after the George Floyd stuff to COVID. All of these things are very difficult on government executives over the last couple of years. So I know it's been tough, but I just don't think this is what she wants to do.
All right, Brian, you mentioned Governor Kemp, and this was a relationship between the governor and the mayor that fractured pretty early. This was a big change from the cooperative relationship that your old boss, Governor Nathan Deal, had with Mayor Kasim Reed. Do you think there was more the governor could have done from across the street to work more cooperatively with the mayor, even when his approach to things like the pandemic differed from hers? Could he have used a little more diplomacy, and that might have made some of those decisions that you were just talking about a little bit easier for both parties?
You know, maybe it is partisan bias here, but I never felt like he was the one who was poking the bear in that relationship. You know, the mayor was going on national TV and attacking Governor Kemp over the mask mandate issues that we were, you know, going through early last year.
But it was he who pushed the executive order that banned municipalities from having what the mayor considered to be the latitude she needed.
Yeah, and I think maybe what we have here is just a legitimate difference of opinion during a time of crisis where you just have to make decisions and move on. And he made his decision and moved on. And she had a right, certainly not questioning her right, to speak out against it forcefully. And he had a right to slap back a little bit. So I just think that is a case where there were just some legitimate differences of opinion that represented the partisan divide nationally on those same issues. So in that way, it was good politics for Mayor Bottoms, and it was good politics for Governor Kemp to signal to their tribes that they're standing up for their point of view.
Theron, from the mayor's side, could she have done a little more diplomacy with the governor to perhaps have eased that relationship, especially during the pandemic?
I think the first thing we got to be very cautious of is to, again, talk about the mayor as if she resigned and no longer in the job.
I meant up until this point.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I know both the mayor and the governor personally very well. Both of them have understood that they had to do certain things, as Brian just mentioned, to promote what they believe was right to their constituencies, right? And there were times where I know for a fact the governor and the mayor actually agreed on a lot of things privately. Matter of fact, I know that they worked together on some initiative most recently that has been very beneficial to the state of Georgia. But the reason I said let's not talk about her as if she's no longer in a job is because I do think the two leaders are going to have to continue to communicate. You know, I think I talked about this on the podcast, and I can say it now. I was the one who actually facilitated the first meeting between Governor Kemp and Mayor Bottoms. And that meeting was very pleasant. They got along and they talked about a lot of different things. But, you know, I think to compare it to what Kasim Reed and Nathan Deal had is fair, but also just keep in mind a lot of the circumstances were different. You had President Obama in the White House at that time, Dennis. And so I felt like for federal issues, particularly that needed the administration's help, I think Governor Deal relied on Kasim Reed a little bit more than he did even some of the members of the delegation, because Mayor Reed definitely had that inroads to the administration. Got to think about it. When Mayor Bottoms comes into office, it's vice versa, right? And she talked about that during her press conference that, you know, having former President Trump in the White House automatically put everyone in sort of a tribal mode because he was just so divisive. And he forced Republicans like Governor Kemp and others to side with him. And those were oftentimes things that the mayor did not agree on. So ultimately, again, I think they will work together on public safety. They will work together on the economy. They will continue to work together on figuring out how to make sure that people get their vaccine shots. And so I think, again, you'll see some bright moments for them to work together and move forward. But ultimately, I think the relationship was manageable, contentious at times. But, you know, that's just the environment we live in now.
And speaking of relationships, without mentioning her predecessor and former mentor Kasim Reed by name, the mayor threw some shade his way during her press conference, referring to the continuing federal probe of corruption allegations in the previous administration, and saying that, in her words, this thing seemed to literally suck the air out of City Hall. Theron, again, these are two people both of whom you know. That certainly was a cloud over the new administration from the start, but how accurate is it for her to focus on that so much when there were plenty of other challenges that came her way after she took office?
Yeah, you know, I have a very interesting perspective on that. I remember the day vividly in 2010. It was a photo that the Atlanta Journal-Constitution would use often of myself, Peter Amon, who was the chief operating officer at the time, and Mayor Reed, and we're standing in his ceremonial office, and we're drinking Cokes. And at that point, you know, you were proud to hold up a Coca-Cola and didn't have to worry about Republicans attacking you for it. But, you know, he came in with a lot of challenges. Pension reform was a big one. He had to fulfill his promise really quickly about getting 2,000 police officers, and had a couple other things, had some water challenges, had to make a decision about the airport and the leadership at the airport. But the difference was, Dennis, is that as soon as the mayor literally walked in office and I was there with her on her first day, she had an ongoing federal investigation where people in the Reed administration were going to jail. I mean, that's just a fact. And many of these folks who have gone to jail, who have been indicted, who've served their time and came out are friends of mine. I know them personally. I work with some of them. And so I think while we do understand that not everybody who worked in the Reed administration were bad people, and they definitely did some really good work for the city, but there were a few people who made some mistakes and did some bad things. And ultimately, Mayor Bottoms had to deal with that. I mean, to just take our listeners inside, Dennis, this was reported on. Just even a staffing. I mean, she didn't know who to trust. She didn't know how to even like vet everyone appropriately, because got to remember the federal investigation, they were not sharing extensive details with the public. And I don't know what they were sharing with her, right? I mean, she would have the answer to that question. But can you imagine walking into a new job and knowing that you could be talking to anyone who could be talking to the FBI or have done something that you don't know? And so I think what she articulated was, in January of 2018, at a time where she was trying to really figure out just how to run the city and get good people hired, you had this ongoing investigation that really sucked up a lot of her time and energy. And I think it also hurt her in recruiting too, Dennis, because a lot of folks who were very talented, people who would want to come work in the city of Atlanta and work for an outstanding, you know, mayor who ran a really good campaign and beat a formidable candidate in Mary Norwood, it was challenging to recruit good people who wanted to come to a city that was under a federal investigation. It even affected my work, right? I had to be extremely careful. Brian, I've talked about this, right? I would often tell Brian, like, hey, we got to be careful, you know, when you're doing stuff at the state and the city, but particularly the city, because you had an ongoing federal investigation. And so I think it was liberating for her, Dennis, to really just talk about it and take people inside of what she was thinking, because she got criticized very early on for not doing a lot of things that the Reed administration were doing, but she just didn't know who to trust. She didn't know who she could work with. She didn't know where this investigation was going. And it really sucked up her personal energy and time in her first really 2 years of her administration.
You know, those early days were certainly very hard. And I remember we were, you know, in the studio recording sometime in early 2018. It was shortly after she had taken office, but a few months in. And I said on the podcast, why is she not holding a news conference and saying, we're making a clean break with the past? We're going to fully cooperate with this federal investigation. There's obviously some malfeasance here. There is some deep rot here that we have to clear out. And I'm the mayor who's going to do it. I'm going to make sure that Atlanta's taxpayers have every faith that their dollars are used responsibly and ethically and legally. And we're going to get rid of the bad actors because they are a bad reflection on the great workers here who serve the people of Atlanta every day with integrity. That just never happened. And I couldn't figure out why at the time. And I still can't figure out why. Was it loyalty to Kasim Reed because they had been friends and he had, you know, worked on her behalf in her campaign and, you know, made clear that she was the pick? I don't know, but it was, I think, a missed opportunity that got her off on the wrong foot. It was almost like she was a continuation of the Reed administration, where she had to be in a defensive posture as opposed to an offensive posture, where she could be the new fresh face bringing change. It just didn't happen. And then more recently, I've seen that same reticence about getting out there in the fray, being the leader when it comes to this crime issue. You know, we saw the talent she has last year when she got up there and told everybody to go home. You know, Theron tells me she doesn't like it, but she was like a mom in the neighborhood that you trust and you listen to. She's got that ability. But, you know, then we had the shootings around the Wendy's. We had the shooting at Fitz Plaza. And we don't hear from her. And I just never really understood it. She had opportunities on the communications front where, again, she is talented. I have said this all along. And she just didn't play to her strengths of communicating with the people of Atlanta, where she is a leader, where she is as a mother, where she is as mayor.
Brian, that's not true. Let me walk you through it for your memory. All right. So the mayor gets elected in 2017, and the first thing she did in 2018 is that she fully cooperated with the FBI investigation. You know this from being a former communications director, and you read the same stories that I read. And now that she's not running for re-election anymore, I can talk more freely about this. The city hall went from basically not responding to open records requests from the press to now this administration, the bottom administration, turning over everything. I've talked to former communications directors, press secretaries that work for the mayor, and even the current folks. They're getting hundreds of requests a day. So the first thing is to say that she did not cooperate with the investigation into City Hall is blatantly false. The second thing that she did that Brian doesn't want to give her any credit for, and this is why, you know, when people see that someone is not running anymore, they take time to try to take shots at them. She opened up city government. She became one of the most transparent mayors in the country. You literally right now can go online and see all the transactions. And she did that because it was all these complaints about people not getting information, people not knowing what they're spending. She had sweeping changes in the ethics office and how things are investigated. I mean, she in her first year, she was the exact opposite as far as transparency and cooperation than the former administration. And then the last thing to say that she just didn't take advantage of her press conferences, she did. I mean, she would go and she would talk to the media. And the truth of the matter is the media, honestly, at times gave her a fair shot, but they were just so focus on tying her to Kasim Reed. And one of the things that I think that I'm the most proud of the mayor, Dennis, is that to say that she's just like Kasim Reed and she was beholden to Kasim Reed, she immediately then and now has shown the people of Atlanta that she's her own mayor. She's an independent leader. She's an independent Black woman. And I just have to say this, that I know both of them personally. When I tell you that if you just look at what she was able to clean up, what she was able to implement, things that she's done around affordable housing, criminal justice reform. These were all things that the prior administration just didn't do. And so, again, we got to tell the story correctly. She was very transparent. She continues to be transparent. She came in with ethics reform. She cleaned up the procurement office. So many people were complaining about procurement. She totally revamped that whole entire department. And then lastly is that she did cooperate. And guess what, Brian? She's still cooperating with this federal investigation, right? I mean, it's not over. And so I just think we got to be very careful not to tell the truth when we're talking about elected officials and their legacy in this city.
Let's jump now into what next. It's tempting to jump straight into the question of who might or might not get into the race for mayor, and we will. But before that, briefly, I want to get a sense from both of you on what any successful candidate will have to address in Atlanta's changing political and economic landscape. I mean, it's ironic that one of Mayor Bottoms' first challenges, a cyber attack, is back in front of people's minds again with the hack of the Colonial Pipeline system. Theron, I'll start with you again. The crime is certainly the issue most often mentioned right now, but what are some others you think the next mayor and the candidates will have to face?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind is the issue around homelessness. I know from talking to a lot of people in the city, I've spent the last week touring the city. I've gone to the east side, the west side. And the thing, of course, that comes up immediately is public safety. But the second issue and third issue, Dennis, is definitely homelessness, but it's also the economy. I think while people don't give Mayor Bottoms enough credit for making choices and not raising people's property taxes to try to stimulate the economy and balance the budget, people forget that she paid essential workers on the front line during this pandemic, gave them actually more money. But I think that you've got to figure out, if you're going to be the next mayor of Atlanta, a way to pull together a coalition to deal with the issue of homelessness. We've seen people coming to the city of Atlanta from other cities and other states. You see more tents going up across the city. And so there's a mental illness aspect of this that I think that the next leader of the city, he or she has got to really be able to pull that together. The last thing I would say, Dennis, is I think some people want to know that they have a mayor that really is going to continue to do what Mayor Bottoms is doing. And that is focusing on basic services, you know, making sure the trash is picked up. You know, let's continue to remove the potholes and make sure that people can get their permits. But I would say homelessness and really having a sincere approach to it, working with the corporate community, working with activists and churches and other organizations that are trying to make sure that they are taken care of. But I would definitely put that at the top of the list.
I think that the issue of the year in this campaign is going to be crime, crime, crime. And that is what is being discussed. And it is in every quarter of the city. It is not just rich white people in Buckhead. It is everywhere that this is top of mind. And we have a bit of lawlessness and chaos, and it's terrifying. The street racing issue, for example, being just one of many. And of course, it's a much larger issue that we have this epidemic of shootings every weekend with kids killing kids. That in turn will lead into a second issue that the next mayor is going to have to face and is going to need, in my opinion, to address on the campaign trail this year. And that is the City of Buckhead movement, which would, of course, be devastating to the city of Atlanta should that take effect.
And Brian, let me interrupt you for just a second, because I wanted to pursue that one with you. During the taping of our last episode, you had a chat, which didn't make the air because it was immediately dated by the mayor's announcement. You had a chat with former Atlanta City Council President Kathy Woolard, who was filling in for Theron and who has decided not to run for mayor, by the way. Again, this happened just before the mayor made her announcement, and Kathy predicted that if the mayor were defeated, that would at least temporarily take the wind out of the sails of the Buckhead City movement, and that the advocates for Buckhead City would give the new mayor time to address their concerns and complaints. Has the mayor's decision done that, do you think?
Well, as Theron has said repeatedly on this podcast, Mayor Bottoms is still mayor. She hasn't died and she hasn't resigned. And so I think as long as that's the case, the movement is still going to have some fuel under it. I think if the candidate who wins speaks to the people of Buckhead in a way that is reassuring, that action is going to be taken, that changes are coming, that we're going to stand with law enforcement and make sure that they're not punished for enforcing the law, I think that would give the next mayor a little bit of breathing room in the first half, or maybe the entirety of 2022, to get things in order. If it's a candidate that doesn't speak to those concerns or that scares the people on the north side of Atlanta, then I think that it just puts gas in the tank. You know, or these days, gas in the plastic bag, gas in the container for hoarding purposes.
Very quickly, we talked about Kathy Woolard a moment ago. She was with us in our last episode. She has since decided not to jump into the mayoral field. Theron, I'll start with you. We already have several candidates, including a couple of fairly well-known names, Sharon Gay, who's an attorney with a lot of experience in city government, and of course, City Council President Felicia Moore. We also have Council Member Antonio Brown. Anybody else that you can see who might jump in?
Yeah, you're going to have a few more people probably announce here shortly. There's a lot of folks sort of looking at this now from a different lens because they know that they would have faced a very tough uphill battle to try to defeat incumbent mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms. And so I think Atlanta needs someone who's going to come in with a new vision. I think we need someone fresh. You know, election is about the future, not about the past. So I don't think we need to go backwards in this city. I personally think that it needs to be someone who's an outsider, a man or woman who wants to come in with new, fresh ideas, who can bring a different coalition of people together, who can reach maybe across the aisle and work with folks at the state, who actually understands the concerns. And Brian wants us to believe that, you know, I live in Buckhead, that we're in this sort of third world country in this terror zone up here. But, you know, we definitely got some challenges, but I think that it's improving. And you'll see some statistics come out here pretty soon that backs up what I'm saying. But yeah, you're going to have a few more people who are looking at it. I think some folks are going to have to do some soul searching and quite frankly, to figure out, you know, their finances and whether or not their families are ready to endure the type of campaign that I think is going to be very divisive. I think it's going to be very heated at times. And I think the people of Atlanta is going to see through this sort of divide that people are trying to push. They only focus on some of the concerns that Buckhead residents have. As I mentioned in my previous comments, I spent a lot of time in the last week and a half traveling throughout the city, talking to everyone who would possibly talk to me. And believe it or not, we have a lot of listeners in this show that don't live in Buckhead who are tired of us talking about Buckhead all the time. That's one of the things that I was very happy to hear. But yeah, I mean, you're going to see a couple more folks jump in. But I think the ability to raise money, have name recognition, have a base of support are all things that I got to be considered from people who are thinking about jumping in this mayor's race.
You threw out something tempting there. You said an outsider. Do you have someone specific in mind?
I actually do. I do.
Who is it?
I do. That person, he or she has got to do a little bit more soul searching, have some more conversations. Got to really figure out what's best for his or her family. But I do think it needs to be someone who is fresh, someone who is, not currently in the system. Everyone can't blame Mayor Bottoms for crime in the city of Atlanta. We have some council members that deserve some of that blame too. So I definitely think that the city of Atlanta, based on my intel and what I'm hearing, is open for an outsider, someone who's new, refreshing, who can work with Republicans, work with the North and South side, someone who can actually build coalitions in our neighborhoods, can work with the Atlanta public school system. I do believe you'll see that person really seriously consider entering this race.
You mentioned the public school system. Maria Karstarfin, the former school superintendent, has talked about running.
Maria and I have actually developed a pretty good relationship. You'll be happy to know that. A lot of our listeners may remember the former superintendent and I definitely had some words for each other on this podcast. But I will say this, and I think Maria is okay with me saying this publicly. When Congressman Lewis became ill and when he passed away, the former superintendent and I have developed a pretty good relationship, talking pretty often just about life and about, her and what she's planning to do personally and professionally. So I don't know if she's thinking about running. She has not articulated that to me yet. But she was definitely someone who was rumored early on to take on the mayor. And then for months, we didn't hear from her. I would be anxious to see if she sort of reappears, but I can't say anything on this podcast about her intentions to want to run for mayor.
Brian, another name that has surfaced recently is because she was just named to the Mayor's Commission on Crime, former acting U.S. Attorney General Sally Yates. She is apparently getting at least a toe back into the water in city issues. Is that a name that is even talked about much?
She's obviously someone who brings a lot of gravitas and is one of the few people. And this is a little different now because, she did have that blow up with Trump in his early days, which maybe perhaps made her more of a divisive, more partisan figure than she had been in the past. But, she was always well respected on the Republican side. When she was given her first high-ranking position in the Justice Department, Republican Senators Johnny Isaacson and Saxby Chambliss sat beside her at the hearing and advocated for her hiring in that job. So she's somebody who's well-respected and certainly was well-respected in the Deal administration. She was U.S. Attorney during the early days of Deal's governorship. And of course, I can talk about this now and have a little bit of a laugh in my voice, but it wasn't funny at the time. A lot of Democrats and Republicans in 2010 were pushing Sally Yates as U.S. Attorney for Atlanta to indict Nathan Deal. People forget this because he's this beloved, respected figure now who left office with historically high approval ratings in a bipartisan fashion in this state. But in 2010, people had a different opinion. And she looked at the facts. She did not act in a partisan way. She acted in a responsible way. And as a result of that, Georgians got to have 8 great years under what I consider to be the greatest governor in the history of the state. So I have a soft spot for her because of that. She will be well respected. I don't know what her network in Atlanta is. She's been gone a lot over the last decade in D.C. She's been teaching at Georgetown. She's a character in an HBO show. I mean, she's kind of going to a different level. But I will say this. She has been rumored to be a potential candidate for governor and other high-ranking jobs as they've come open, and she's just expressed no interest whatsoever in elected politics. And
I was just about to say that she has never really seemed interested in an elected job.
No, just not really her thing. And yeah.
So who else are you thinking of that might jump in?
Well, Farron Johnson, for one. And I think when he says, you know, he or she, I think he's talking about himself, and the she, of course, is his wife. I just want to say on the front end, I'm going to miss him on the show when he decides to run. It's been great these 6 years. And, you know, I promise, despite our friendship, to be tough and to be critical of Farron and praise him as he deserves when he is mayor or if he's a candidate for mayor. So that's the name I would throw out.
Farron?
Brian is trying to definitely cause some tension in my household. I mean, look, let's deal with it, right? I mean,
yeah, let's.
You know, this is probably not the right thing to do for my clients. No, look, I mean, Brian knows me very well. I mean, Brian and I are friends. We're not talking as much as we used to because we've had some fights, some good fights, good fights on this podcast.
Good trouble.
No, yeah. I mean, look. Do I think I would be a good mayor? Absolutely. I think I could bring the city together. I think that if you look at my leadership in electing high-profile Democrats, I mean, the list from President Barack Obama to now President Biden to Congressman John Lewis, former Mayor Kasim Reed, current Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, you know, worked for former Mayor Bill Campbell, Sharon Gay did as well. So, you know, we got to make sure we continue to include him in the conversation about, you know, mayors. Dennis, I definitely think I could run a good campaign. I think people who listen to this show know that I'm a very honest broker. I call balls and strikes. I don't shy away from my relationships. But, you know, the thing that is tough for me and my family right now is that we've been blessed to make some money, to do well for ourselves. I have a beautiful, loving wife who I've been married to now for a couple of years, and we have a 10-month-old son in Tyson. And so, you know, when I wake up this morning, looking at his eyes, I know he's going to ask me that question. He's going to say, Daddy, why did you run for mayor or why didn't you run for mayor? And the frustrating thing about it is that I've actually been too successful to just make a knee-jerk reaction decision and just go and put everything that I've been able to build and so much that I do for others. Brian knows this. I spend 90% of my day, Dennis, working for others. You know, all the clients, my family, so many people depend on me to deliver for them. So I'm just really considering, do I make a selfish decision and start doing something that I want to do? And that is lead the city that I love, that I've supported so many mayors and helped them achieve their objectives. I just wonder, is the city ready for an outsider, someone like me or someone not like me? And I really mean, it could be a woman, it could be a man. I mean, I'm open to seeing who that person is, but it's got to be someone that can bring this city together. And it's got to be someone that has earned the right to run and that the people know and they trust based on their leadership and based on their deliverables. And so, you know, it's an ongoing conversation in the Johnson household. I'll just tell you that.
Do you have a timetable for making a decision? Because there are outside pressures to do that with fundraising, and we're only 6 months away from the election.
You know, Brian knows what I'm thinking. I'm not really worried about the money, Dennis. I think if I were to run, I could actually raise money pretty quickly. I think the thing that is most important is my love for this city and my respect and loyalty to this mayor. The question I got to ask myself, am I better serving my city to make sure that her next 6 months, that she finishes strong? Or do I have enough time, to your point, Dennis, to basically get out in a city that's very divided right now and take this pay cut and really, you know, I have people who work for me who are depending on me to make sure that they continue to get paid during this deadly pandemic. So I'm not going to be rushed by the ability to raise money. I think the timeline is based upon who jumps in. And if someone fits what I just described, then I can continue doing what I'm doing and live a happy life. But if I feel that it's not someone who's going to represent the future and not the past, someone's going to take us forward, not backward, then I'll make this decision very soon.
We're going to have to do a short, like one word or two word answer to this, because the one name that has been rumored out there that we haven't mentioned is the former mayor, Kasim Reed. Brian, starting with you, do you think he gets in?
Well, he's certainly making the rounds. I had some friends who saw him at a high roller place for dinner earlier this week. And so he is getting out there. His people, they aren't excluded, but some of people in his circle have been certainly making noises that he's going to do it. And he's put his neck out there in a way that he had not in the past. You know, certainly pushing back on Mayor Bottoms at times or showing public disagreement with her. He's definitely engaging in the public sphere in a way that you might do when you're testing the waters. But I will say this, Bottoms brought up a good point in her news conference. The investigation is still ongoing. Up to this juncture, Kasim Reed has avoided being in the line of fire directly. I mean, a lot of bullets have flown around him, but none have gone through his skin. And if he pops his head up in this way, you have to wonder, and I have talked to people in high-ranking positions of law enforcement who say it would be a mistake for him to do so because of that.
I'm not sure what he's going to do, Dennis. I have not spoken to the former mayor in years, maybe a few years. So I can't really give you any insight on what he's going to decide to do. But what I can tell you is that I think he understands data. I think he understands that this would be a tough race for him or anyone. And I think that, you know, if someone comes along that he feels is ready and prepared for this moment, like he was prepared and ready for his moment when he ran, I think he will stand down.
Very interesting. And we have taken a lot of time in this episode on city politics. We're going to take a quick break and race through a couple of other subjects, including some bills the governor signed. That and more when the Political Breakfast continues. Stay right here.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org. Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
And we are back on the Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare with Republican strategist Brian Robinson and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson. Guys, we're going to have to go quickly through these next few subjects. It was bill signing season for Governor Kemp. He signed bills that overhauled the state's citizen's arrest law, which was cited by the three men charged in the Ahmaud Arbery killing. He signed bills to ban local governments from defunding police, signed a bill to crack down on street racing, all of those signings done with a lot of public fanfare. But there was another bill that was signed with no notice at all, and this one would allow committees that support the reelection bids of people like the governor and legislative leaders, among others, to collect unlimited amounts of money, money going to those committees, and they could do it during the legislative session, which has always been a no-go zone. Brian, this from a governor and legislature that was concerned about water distribution influencing voters waiting in line. Doesn't this allow unlimited and anonymous influencing of the people who make the laws while they are making them?
You know, I think what you're seeing here is a greater movement toward funding campaigns outside of party structures. And I think that's going to be the real change that takes place here. It's going to siphon more money out of the Democratic Party, the state Republican Party, and into the leadership at the General Assembly, where they make these decisions directly.
But real quickly, and I apologize because our time is short, does it A, give incumbents an unfair advantage, and B, basically amount to legalized bribery during the legislative session?
No. I mean, look, members of Congress and the President of the United States accept donations all year long, and we don't raise those issues. This is part of how our process has worked. Yes, Georgia has long had a law that prevents state elected officials from raising money during the General Assembly session. And this is an exception to that, but it's not an exception to American norms.
Yeah, I'll be quick. I think this is one that you're going to see both sides sort of promote, that this is something that is not going to impact and influence legislators' ability to make decisions and votes in a negative way. But then you're going to definitely hear the other side, that people feel that for so many years, incumbents, state legislators have not been able to raise money at all for generally a 3 to 4 month period. And so folks can legitimately argue that this gives them an advantage. And then some people can say, to Brian's point, that this is something that happens in Congress. And so I think this was one that the governor had to wait until the very last moment to sign. I'm sure he did his due diligence to vet it with his internal people. And I'm sure some incumbent legislators are happy that they'll be able to raise that money now. But ultimately, when it starts getting to the timing of the votes of bills and when was decisions made and what dinners were had and what checks were written at what time and for what amount and from who, it's definitely going to now be another layer of discussion around how legislation is crafted and passed in the Georgia House and Senate.
Well, Brian, back to the original question, you know, the governor and lawmakers have said, oh, we're worried about influencing people in line by giving to vote by giving them water. And here you've got this. If it were so benign and such a continuation of norms, why did the governor sign it without telling anyone?
Well, the governor signs hundreds of bills, and it is a decision process within the governor's office, one that I was a part of for five sessions from 2011 through 2015, to determine which ones merit public consumption or public interest. And you know, obviously, this isn't one that's going to be like, how does this affect the people of X city in Georgia? Well, you know, the budget affects people in Georgia. It has to do with healthcare spending, education spending, the foster care and adoption reforms that were made, the criminal justice reform, like the citizen's arrest law. Those are all things that are much more public interest. I don't question at all the reasoning for not making this a public event. What would even be the visual for this event? This is very much an insider's bill that is not going to be of interest to the everyday life. I won't say not of interest. It's just not something that's going to impact the lives of day-to-day Georgians. And I reject the comparison to standing in line. The whole thing with the water bottles is a made up issue. Right? It's, let's be honest, it's a made up issue. Nobody died, had a heat stroke within 150 feet of the polling station. This is about protecting voters from being harassed in line. That's what this is about.
Let's jump now to, again, an all too brief consideration of another political decision, this one by Republican State Attorney General Chris Carr, who had been among those mentioned as a possible candidate to challenge Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock. He's decided not to go there. He's running for re-election to his current job. Brian, Chris Carr could still face a primary challenge from what you might call the Trump wing of the Georgia GOP. But one would have to assume he figured his chances of winning were better as an incumbent attorney general than as a contender in what might turn out to be a crowded GOP Senate primary, even though it's not too busy at the moment.
And as I've said before, I have to disclose that I am an advisor to Chris Carr, and I see him numerous times a week and discuss these things. So I have to be careful in what I say because I can't, you know, discuss internal deliberations. But I think looking at it from the outside, you know, obviously running for re-election is a much clearer path to getting to the general election. He's able to run on his record there, which is a strong one. And it's an issue-based campaign that sets up well for him right now in the AG's race. Again, going back to the city politics, we're talking about crime. Well, crime is an issue statewide, too. I think this is going to be a major issue for Republicans across Georgia and across the United States. This idea, Theron's going to blast this, and that's fine, but it's still true and real to many voters that Democrats have turned their back on law enforcement. The defund the police movement became a rallying cry. Police have been vilified. And we're seeing the predictable outcome of crime rising around the country, criminals acting with impunity. There's a rising death toll as a result of that. And Republicans are able to come in during that atmosphere and say, I'm going to be tough on crime. I'm going to put criminals away. I'm not going to make excuses for criminals. And I think that's a great message going into 2022, where the Democrats are going to have to choose between that law and order message and what their base really wants to hear, which isn't law and order.
Theron, there are two Democrats in the race already, State Senator Jen Jordan and former Fulton County Prosecutor Charlie Bailey, who was the nominee last time and almost made it then. Does Chris Carr's decision make it tougher for them now?
No, I think many of us on the Democratic side knew that Attorney General Chris Carr would run for re-election. I think the challenging thing for the AG is that he's definitely young, he's talented, and he's ambitious. And he knows that he's been preparing for these moments, serving under his mentor and friend and hero, Senator Johnny Isaacson. I'm sure Brian has had very honest conversations like he's had with me about the attorney general's future and really the climate if he were to try to seek higher office. But he will now be able to speak boldly. I think we just got a snapshot, a snippet of what the attorney general is going to start talking about from what Brian just said, admitting that public safety and crime is a statewide issue, right? So you're going to probably see the attorney general come out and speak more boldly. I would tell you hypothetically this, Dennis, if I were to choose to run for mayor, one of the first meetings I would have, and I would publicly say it to the people of Atlanta, that I'm going to meet with the attorney general, because I think there's ways that you can work together with that state agency collectively to agree on some things that the city and the state can work on to make sure that law and order and criminal justice reform, but also public safety is there. And the last thing I would say is this. I think that the next mayor of Atlanta, he or she has got to be someone that makes police officers, men and women who put their lives on the line every single day, to make sure that they feel that they're supported, and that if they make a mistake and do something that is wrong, that they will be punished, but they will at least get an investigation and they will get a due process. But you know, one of the things that I would caution the Democrats not to do is to go down what Brian just described, and that is allow the Republicans to make us into these people who want to defund the police and don't believe in what they do for us day in and day out. I think the message I would have for Democrats is that it's okay to push police reform, and we should, and we definitely need more training to support our officers. But you got to be very careful that you don't get to a point where you start costing Democrats their elections, because you give the Republicans an opportunity to make the citizens and the voters believe that we are against police officers and what they do, the good things they do for us every day. So I think that's what the attorney general's race is going to turn to. But we got some good candidates, and I think it'll be a competitive race.
And speaking of law and order, we cannot leave without wrapping up very quickly on something that might undercut the Republican message on that. This week, in a hearing on the insurrection at the Capitol, Georgia Congressman, a Republican, Andrew Clyde, who represents the Athens area and Northeast Georgia, compared the insurrection to a tourist visit. And he said there was no insurrection. And he said, you know, if you didn't know the TV footage was a video from January the 6th, you'd actually think it was a normal tourist visit. Brian, I've been covering politics, if you count my work in college radio, for 50 years. I've never heard anything like that by someone in power ever. Does this undercut the, you know, if it's allowed to go forward, does it undercut the Republicans' message that they are supporting law and order and our legal processes?
You know, one thing I always try to do on here, and Theron does as well, is that when situations are nuanced or gray, that, you know, we explain that. Not everything is extremes here in politics. I can't do that in this situation because this is cut and dry. What he said is wrong. What he said is delusional. What he said is Orwellian and scary. And
it's dangerous, isn't it? This is a congressman.
It's dangerous. And this is a political podcast. And so let me say, this is bad politics. The middle in America, the middle in Georgia determines elections. And this makes Republicans look Looney Tunes. Now, I don't think that his viewpoint is representative of rank and file Republicans in this state. God help us if it is. But I do feel like responsible citizens, regardless whether the Republicans or Democrat, have to stand up and say, that's nuts. That's nuts. And it is. And you know, I obviously say it when the Democrats are lying, like they lied about the elections bill. But what he is saying is not accurate.
I don't think I need to say anything. Dennis, I think you and Brian articulated exactly what I was going to say.
And that is it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, a public affairs and government consultant, and most recently a senior advisor to the Biden Georgia campaign. Thanks so much to you both.
Happy birthday to my wife.
I want to express my sincere condolences to former city councilman in Atlanta, C.T. Martin.
And you can follow us on Twitter. Brian is at Lord Tinsdale. That's T-I-N-S-D-A-L-E. Theron is at Theron Johnson. And I'm at D-E-N-I-S-O-H-A-Y-E-R. Our thanks to Kevin Rinker and Lowell Berlanti for their production assistance. And if you like this show, please subscribe. It is free wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That is a great way to make sure other people can find us. And don't forget to check out the other wonderful podcasts from WABE, up-to-the-minute information on the coronavirus, on Did You Wash Your Hands with Sam Whitehead, a deep dive into the politics and money in one corner of the gun debate. Lisa Hagan brings you No Compromise. And then there's the Peabody Award-winning Buried Truths. Hank Klibanoff unearths details about the murder of Ahmaud Arbery in Brunswick. And here on The Political Breakfast, we will be back in your feed and in your head real soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us and have a great and a safe week.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now plugged in, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.